Eliza Anderson, the William K. Landman professor of sociology at Yale University. And I'm an urban ethnographer, which means I study real people. I visit communities, I interview people, I observe people, and then I try to represent the reality that they live with day-to-day, every day. And I've been looking at inner-city poor communities, specifically at the problem of urban violence over the years. Of all the problems besetting the poor inner-city black community, none is more pressing than that of interpersonal violence and aggression. It wreaks havoc every day in the lives of community residents, and increasingly spills over into downtown and residential middle-class areas. Muggings, burglaries, carjackings, and drug-related shootings, all of which may leave their victims or innocent bystanders dead. But the inclination to violence springs from the circumstances of life among the ghetto poor, the lack of jobs that pay a living wage, the stigma of race, the fallout from rampant drug use and drug trafficking, and the resulting alienation and lack of hope for the future. This is the big issue for so many people living in these circumstances. Just by living in this situation is to be at a certain risk. In this community, there are undoubtedly forces that can counteract the negative influences. And by far, the most powerful is the strong and loving, decent family, as the residents put it, committed to middle-class values. But the despair in the community is pervasive enough to have spawned an oppositional culture, that of the streets, whose norms are often consciously opposed to those of mainstream society. And see, these two orientations, decent and street, socially organize the community, and their coexistence has important consequences for residents, especially children growing up in the inner city. Above all, the environment means that even young people whose home lives reflect mainstream values, and the majority of the homes in the community do, and that's very important to appreciate. These individuals must be able to handle themselves in what has become a more street-oriented environment. And this is because the street culture has evolved what may be called a code of the street, which amounts to a set of informal rules governing interpersonal public behavior, including violence. Now, the rules prescribe both a proper comportment and a proper way to respond if challenged. They regulate the use of violence and so supply a rationale which allows those who are inclined to aggression to precipitate violent encounters in an approved way. The rules have been established and are enforced mainly by the street-oriented, but on the street, the distinction between street and decent is often irrelevant. Everybody knows that if the rules are violated, there are penalties. Thus, knowledge of this code is largely defensive, but it is literally necessary for operating in the public spaces in so many of these disenfranchised communities. Therefore, even though families with a decency orientation are usually opposed to the values of the code, they often reluctantly encourage their children's familiarity with it to enable them to negotiate the inner city environment. At the heart of this code is the issue of respect. Now, loosely, it's defined as being treated right or granted the deference or the props that one deserves. But in this troublesome public environment, as people feel increasingly buffeted by the forces beyond their control, what one deserves in the way of respect becomes more and more problematic and uncertain. And this, in turn, further opens the issue of respect or street credibility to sometimes intense impersonal negotiation. In the street culture, especially among young people, street cred is viewed as almost an external entity that is hard won but easily lost. And so when you have it, you must constantly guard it and never secure it once and for all, but is dependent on a series of performances that effectively answer challenges and aggressions by others. It is in this way that one's street credibility is established. And when possessed and successfully claimed, it works to deter advances. With the right amount, a person can avoid being bothered in public. In fact, the rules of the code provide a framework for negotiating street credibility. The person whose very appearance, including his clothing, demeanor, and way of moving, deters transgressions, can feel that he possesses and may be considered by others to possess a measure of respect. He is reminded of this by the way he is treated and the way he is regarded. Thus, if he is bothered and advances are made to his person, not only may he be in physical danger, but he has been disgraced, disrespected, and often feels vulnerable to further and possibly more serious advances. Though many of the forms that dissing can take might seem petty to middle-class people, eye contact too long, for example, on the streets being dissed is always consequential, particularly to those invested in the street code. Such actions become serious indications of the other person's intentions. Or left unanswered, can seriously erode one's street credibility. Consequently, young people become very sensitive to advances and slights, which could well serve as warnings of imminent physical confrontation and or danger. And again, I say that this hard reality can be traced to the profound sense of alienation from mainstream society and its institutions felt by so many poor inner-city black people, especially the young. The code of the street is actually a cultural adaptation to a profound lack of faith in the police and the judicial system. The police are most often seen by residents as representing the dominant society and not caring to protect inner-city residents. When called, they may not respond, which is one reason many residents feel they must be prepared to take extraordinary measures to defend themselves and their loved ones against those who are inclined to aggression. In fact, lack of police accountability has been incorporated into the local status system. The person who is believed capable of, quote, taking care of himself is accorded a certain deference, which translates into a sense of physical and psychological control. Thus, the street code emerges where the influence of the police and the justice system ends and personal responsibility for one's safety is felt to begin. Hence, when respect for the civil law erodes, street justice fills the void, thus underscoring the need for street credibility to operate on the streets of the local community. Exacerbated by the proliferation of drugs and easy access to guns, this volatile situation promises those with unassailable street credibility, often with street-oriented minority, the opportunities to dominate the public spaces, you see. And that's the situation that we have to deal with in our urban environments today in order to cut this high violence rate and the high homicide rates that are just killing too many of our young people.
Can you talk a little bit about having been on the streets and what you were seeing and maybe paint the picture of eye contact as one element?
Every interaction is important, and to look at a person, to look at a person in the eye, can be in some sense a threat. To look someone directly in the eye can be taken as a threat. The next point is tension, and then some resolution, and sometimes resolution can only be accomplished through physicality. If you have not physicality, then gunplay. And this is not something that is very pretty, but this is part of the the code of the street, you see.
I think you also wrote you could never predict when a young man from a decent family might cause somebody else some harm, depending on what he faces on the street.
Yeah. Well, the situation is all about, and the issue here is that so much of what the young man is dealing with, and young woman too, increasingly, is a situation that is untenable. You see.
Could I ask you how you balanced doing your research and being safe yourself, or safe enough?
Well, I come from a poor inner city background. I grew up in a poor inner city background, and that doesn't mean that I'm, you know, that I know all that there is to know about this, but I'm somewhat familiar with this environment and the codes and all that, and to the extent that I am and can read situations and then behave accordingly, I can keep myself somewhat safe. On the streets, there's a premium placed on knowing what time it is. You know, that's what the boys on the corner say. And to know what time it is to, I mean, not by the clock, but by who's around and what can happen. You know, just what to do and how to behave. Your behavior is in sync with the situation that's geared towards prevailing, or at least staying safe. So to some extent, in order to negotiate public spaces, one has to be somewhat streetwise.
What has the response been to your research, to your writing?
Well, a lot of people, I think, have found them illuminating and have found that they can understand the situation somewhat better. I think that's a good thing. The next question is, what do we do about this with respect to policy? And I think one of the things that needs to be done is to provide opportunities for the marginalized, disenfranchised communities that exist in this country, in the urban areas. As I said, presently we're moving through profound change from manufacturing to service and high technology in the context of an increasingly global economy, where the jobs are being sent away to non-metropolitan America or even overseas. The real issue is employment opportunities. And so many of the manufacturing concerns that used to undergird and stabilize so many of these poor communities today are gone. And the jobs that used to be high-paying and low-skilled have been replaced by service opportunities that oftentimes don't pay people enough to live. People find themselves working two or three jobs. And so we're talking about structural poverty. And if you combine that with the ways in which so many of these, so much of this poverty is racialized, that is seen in these concentrated urban ghettos, as it were, then it becomes ever more a problem of race. But it's not simply that, of course, because these are structural issues that affect not just black people, but the working class in general in this country, especially the people who are disenfranchised. And these can be poor whites, these can be Latinos, they can be black. But very oftentimes, given the history of slavery in this country and the manifestation of this situation we have today, it results in this the situation we talk about.
So structural, just to clarify, would mean the foundation of our economy and where jobs are and where they're going?
Well, I mean, what we're talking about here is a situation where so many of the poor people that we see today are not poor because of some failing of their own personal lives, as it were. It used to be that we talked about poverty, and people say, well, this person doesn't want to work, this person is lazy, blah, blah, blah. And so in that situation, the people who had jobs and had opportunities could very easily blame the victim, so to speak. Say, well, this person just is some sort of failure, you know, that kind of thing. When we look at the situation that we see today with the jobs leaving, with people making conscious decisions to move jobs to the suburbs or to move jobs overseas, this is beyond the control of local communities, beyond the control of individuals, you see, in those communities. And it's structural poverty in that sense.
I'm going to ask you a Pollyannish question, because I'm always looking for hope, personally. In your research on this, absolutely. Were there rays of light or hope at all that you saw within those so difficult conditions? Do you see hope there?
Well, you see, the thing of it is the community has changed so. The inner-city poor community has changed so since the time that I was a child. My father was a factory worker. My father worked at Studebaker's, a defunct car manufacturer in South Bend, Indiana. And he had limited education, and he worked in the foundry and made good money. And basically was able to take care of a family and to be an effective role model and to encourage not only myself and my brothers and others to be strong working men, but he even set an example for people in the community, you see. But the kind of job my father had is long gone from the inner city. And that job has been replaced by service jobs that don't pay people enough money to live oftentimes. At the same time, in order to negotiate the system, you really do need human capital. You need schooling, you need skills, you need some kind of education that you're able to negotiate the system with, if you follow me. And so many of the young people in these communities today don't have those opportunities to build that kind of human capital, you see. And it's complicated because many of them are so disenfranchised that they're confused or whatever. Maybe don't even see opportunities when they exist. So it's complicated. It's very complicated. But it's certainly a different world from the way it was when I grew up. You asked me about the positive things that could happen or whatever. And you do see hope in the form of the people who continue to work hard and continue to operate under pressure but still have hope every day. And that's a good thing to see, although the structural conditions certainly make it very difficult for them. And a manifestation of the poverty that we see results oftentimes in they're not being able to prevail.
Who are people that need to come to the table?
Well, I think what we need is some. We need to face the issue. The government needs to face the issue. I think the business community needs to face the issue. You know, we need jobs and opportunities. We need investment in some of these communities that does not exist right now today. We need to develop anti-discrimination measures with respect to poor people. And we need to work to incorporate these people into the employment system better than we do.
You know, when I spoke with these teenagers just a few days ago, there were two different threads that came through. One is that several of them said they're convinced that by the time they get to middle school, that our school system here, let's say, has decided which kids will go to college, which kids will have live, you know, with assistance, and which will be in prison.
Right. Well, one of the things I found out at so many of these inner city schools effectively criminalize poor young black people, males in particular, because, again, the doorways are guarded by policemen. The metal detectors there. There are paddy wagons outside. And if a young man is involved in an altercation or something, oftentimes, very quickly, this is elevated to aggravated assault. And the person is marched off with handcuffs and into the waiting paddy wagon. And he has a record for life. And if you look at what happens in suburban schools, I mean, boys have fights, but they don't get counted as people involved in aggravated assaults and that kind of thing, if you know what I mean. And so this is something that does have an effect on the employment prospects of young people. It has a big effect on their futures, so to speak, whether they go to college or not. And too often, I think, these young people from the ghetto, from the inner city communities, are impacted by this situation in a negative way.
And some of them had the opinion that society welcomes incarcerating black kids or black young men because there's an economy in it.
Yeah, well, there's a feeling, as I mentioned earlier, of deep alienation in the community. And there's a sense that the wider society is really not on your side. The wider society is not about seeing you succeed. In fact, the wider society is out to, work against you in some way. It's not your friend, you know.
Yes.
And this is built in. This is an ideology that a lot of people buy into. And this is not simply the young people sometimes or the street element, but even the quote-unquote decent people. And most of the people are decent and trying to be decent, I think. But living in the environment they live in and having the sense of history that they have,